So in keeping with the theme of today's class, the greater occupation is the size of the car seems to be reduced still further. Maybe I should switch to another topic. Anyhow, we spoke last time of the end of the lesser occupation, a period in which the existence of the 12th Imam was gradually established in the minds of the Shi'i community as a fact, and a period in which he was represented by a succession of four named individuals who were accessible to the community. They served as all the intermediaries between the community and the hidden imam. I pointed out that 6 days before the death of the fourth of the named representatives, Ali Samarri, a communication was received from the imam informing him that he would die and that he, the imam, had already entered into the greater occultation. It was in fact an established custom for each of the named representatives, the wakils or the safirs, to receive a similar communication from the imam predicting their death on a certain date. So it must have been with a certain trepidation that the communication from the hidden imam would be received by the wakil. The difference with this last communication being, of course, that the fourth representative was instructed not to remain a successor and was informed that the imam had gone into the greater occultation. And he warned that during the greater occultation, anyone claiming to represent him should be rejected. That is to say, any single named individual claiming to reject, to have particular privileged communication with the imam, should be rejected. And that he would return once the world had been filled with tyranny and injustice to an unprecedented degree. He remarked also that his ultimate return would be marked not simply by the filling of the world with injustice, but also by certain observable signs, the emergence of a certain individual in Syria called As-Sufyan. We'll come to that later, the re-emergence. And other celestial signs, for example, a voice in the heavens proclaiming that the 12th Imam is to appear, or maybe has already appeared. So this, then, the receipt of this communication by the fourth of the named representatives marked the beginning of the greater occultation. And not surprisingly, the greater occultation, just like the lesser occultation, precipitated a new crisis within the Shia community. For an obvious reason, that now very basic questions such as the utility, the very purpose of an imam who is not simply inaccessible to the majority of his followers but are no longer present on the physical plane, such basic questions came forward, occasioning considerable doubt and hesitation both within and beyond the Shi'i community. It is, of course, possible from a certain point of view to hypothesize that the greater occultation, the beginning of the greater occultation, was again an inspired pragmatic solution to a certain crisis. In other words, in just the same way that the apparent death of the 11th Imam without an issue, without a male issue, had been resolved by proclaiming that indeed such a child existed, but that he was hidden from the community. In just the same way that this had been put forward as a solution to a problematic situation, now likewise, the greater occultation might be conceived of as a pragmatic solution to a new crisis. And what would the nature of that new crisis be? Specifically, the assumption by the wakils, by the named representatives of the hidden imam, of powers and even of attributes that it seemed peculiar to the imams themselves. For example, the ability, miraculously, to estimate, not simply to estimate, in fact to specify precisely the amount of chomps that was being delivered on a certain occasion. We find this being done by the imams and later by some of the wakils. And one theory that has been put forward by historians of this period is that the wakils were becoming more than simple representatives of the imam. They were, whether through force of circumstance or deliberately, taking the place of the imams. But again, this pragmatic hypothetical argument seems untenable for a few reasons. Just as we argued that the pragmatic explanation for the lesser occultation is ultimately untenable. As far as the major occultation is concerned, why would we reject this notion as improbable that the greater occultation was simply the result of a desire to cut short the ambitions of the wakils? Firstly, because although that particular problem might appear to have been solved by ending the institution of the wakana, a very large number of new problems were created by the beginning of the major occultation. In other words, in order to solve one problem, a whole series of new problems have been created. This in itself argues against the likelihood of a conscious, pragmatic, even cynical decision being made to proclaim the greater occultation. The major problem being that which I've already suggested, namely the utility, the purpose, the benefit of having an imam who is in a state of complete occultation, i.e. absence from the physical plane without even a named representative to speak on his behalf, to serve as an intermediary to the community. A very severe problem, solutions to which were, of course, ultimately elaborated. This was indeed a problem, and it is difficult to imagine that the occurrence of this problem would have been ignored, not anticipated, by leaders of the Shia community, if for reasons of their own they had wished to posit a raver, a complete occultation, in the absence of the actual fact. And the second and maybe more important argument is the same as that which we advanced in the previous case, namely the circulation of hadith from various imams from a much earlier period that had spoken precisely of a two-stage raver. That is to say, not only the minor occultation, which had now come to an end, but the major occultation, which had begun. These hadiths had come into circulation many years earlier, and at this point, it seems, because of the particular circumstances of the age, have been attaining greater currency. Among the hadiths in question, we can cite maybe the following two. One from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, in which he says, there will arise from our family, that is from our Ahl al-Bayt, one who will be absent from view, and his whereabouts will be known only to a number of his intimate associates. And then he will be absent from this world, and direct communication with him will be ruptured. So clearly this hadith puts forward two stages of the ghaybah. The first part indicates the lesser occultation, where Ja'far al-Sadiq is recorded to have said that one from our family will be absent from view, i.e. he will be physically present on earth, but absent from view. And his whereabouts will be known only to a number of his intimate associates, i.e. the wakils. And then he will be absent from this world. In other words, the major occultation will follow, and direct communication with him will be ruptured. In other words, there will be no direct communication with him because the institution of the wakana, as the named representatives, has also come to an end. Then we have another hadith from the eighth Imam, Ali al-Ridha, in which he cites the Prophet himself to have said, that there will be from among my descendants 12 leaders. And here I'm translating the word imam. There will be from among my descendants 12 imams, 12 leaders, the last of whom will be Al-Qa'im.
Al-Qa'im, I talked about previously, and I'll come back to a more detailed consideration of it
with respect to the 12th imam.
Al-Qa'im, the last of whom will be Al-Qa'im.
He will enter into occultation and then emerge bearing the sword. He will enter into occultation and then emerge bearing the sword. Therefore, from the 6th and 8th Imams hadith, which clearly indicate the future occurrence of the major occultation. So that we can say there is clear scriptural proof for an anticipation of Al-Ghaybah within, that is to say, the major occultation within the Shia community, despite the problems that were created by its occurrence, problems of both doctrinal and practical nature. Before continuing with a discussion and examination of these problems, it may be good to point out that we can, from a different point of view, see a progression, an overall progression, and therefore a preparation for the occultation in this period of Shi'i history. In other words, we can say, to recapitulate, that the period of the 9th, 10th, and 11th Imams, a period in which the Imams were subject to increasing surveillance and isolation from the community at large, was a preparation for the minor occultation. In other words, the Shia community became used to, accustomed to the idea of, or the reality of, an imam who is indeed present upon earth at a known location, but inaccessible to them. One degree, as it were, of withdrawal from the community, although a forced and an involuntary one. This, in a sense, prepared the community for the minor occultation. In which the imam is still present upon earth, but his whereabouts are unknown, and access to him may be had only through a single named representative. And this, in turn, prepares the community to some degree. Again, we have to point to the persistence of problems and doubts, but to some degree, it is prepared the community for the greater occultation. That is, that far a degree of withdrawal on the part of the imam now took place, which was simply, from one point of view, an intensification of the situation already experienced by the community. Moreover, the 12th imam, in the period of the lesser occultation, is reported to have said the following, that those who try to fix a time for my re-emergence are liars. Those who try to fix a time for my re-emergence are liars. In other words, a prohibition of any attempt to foretell, in precise chronological terms, the time at which the 12th Imam will emerge from his occultation. And if this hadith were in wide circulation at the time, this also must have constituted a type of preparation on the part of the community. In other words, they anticipated the greater occultation, which would be of indefinite duration, and therefore the duty of patience would be imposed upon them. However, having said all of this, that there was a mode of preparation deriving from the historical experience in the immediately preceding period, and also the circulation of hadith that pointed to two stages of the favor, still there were a number of practical problems. There were, for example, questions and doubts raised both at the scholarly level and at the level of the common believers. And we have documentary evidence of this from the writings of a certain scholar who emerged in soon in the period of the greater occultation. It's got a known. Nu'mani writes that people would come to the Imam, would come to him, asking him quite simply, where is the Imam? What is happening with the institution of the Imamate? Such people, in explaining their doubts, giving rise to these questions, they would remark the following, that if the 12th Imam had been born in the year 256, Islamic, 870 of the Common Era, and then gone into occultation, into the major occultation, in the year 329, 941, then he would have been 73 years of age at the beginning of the greater occultation. So it was asked, or at least tentatively suggested, by these questioners, maybe he simply died. After all, 73 years would be a quite reasonable lifespan. Then others went somewhat further, and here we're dealing not with polemics from outside the Shia community, but questions raised within the Shia community. Other people said maybe, the Imam had never existed at all, that there had been no occultation, either minor or major. They said, after all, we never even saw the Imam before the beginning of the greater occultation. It may be imagined that these questions were raised primarily at the popular level, where the traditions, as I have cited, were less liable to be known and in wide circulation. They seem to have led to a temporary defection on the part of some members of the Shia community, but unlike previous succession crises in the history of the Imamate, we do not find now the emergence of any new groups or sects. In other words, these are simply people with doubts and questions who do not go on to form a counter theory of their own, rejecting or disputing the reality of the Khaybah. So this on the popular level. On a scholarly level, and again we know this from the writings of An-Nu'mani, problems or doubts were perceived to exist. No doubt the scholars were better acquainted with the relevant traditions than were the bulk of the community. The traditions such as those that I have cited, pointing to two stages of the Khaybah. But it is plain that many of the scholars expected the major occultation to last a relatively short time. They did not expect it to last indefinitely. They maybe expected it to come to an end even within their own lifetimes. And the indication of this is again the all-important question of the Khubs.
Tax, which is a distinctive feature of Shi'i doctrine and practice.
Remember that the khums was due to, payable to, the imams or to their named representatives. Now, once the major occultation began, the question arose what to do with the khums. Not only the imam is no longer present on the physical plane, he did not have a named representative, a wakil, to whom the money might be sent for him in turn to transmit it to the imam, for the imam then to expend and distribute. Initially, it seems that members of the Shia community were told by the scholars simply to store up the khums in their own houses, whether it be in cash or in kind, or possibly to bury it for safety, in anticipation of the day, which obviously they thought not long in coming, in anticipation of the day when the Imam would return, and therefore be in a position to receive the khums. Alternatively, if individuals were not comfortable with this situation, because after all, from a pious point of view, one is not comfortable if the khums remains in one's possession and should be transferred to an appropriate person for the remainder of one's property to become legitimate for one's use, if not comfortable with that situation, it was suggested that they should simply entrust the money to a scholar, to a scholar trusted by them. However, that scholar could only act as trustee, and since he was not a named authoritative representative of the Imam, he could receive the money but not distribute it. So this set of instructions or suggestions is a clear indication that the return of the Imam from the major occultation was anticipated in the relatively near future, because as yet no alternative mechanism for collection and distribution had been elaborated. So one can say that there was a practical question, in fact several practical questions, this being the most obvious, accompanying the beginning of the major occultation, in just the same way that there was that fundamental doctrinal problem, the benefit of an imam in a state of occultation without a single named representative. Later, it is difficult, of course, to set a date for this, it became apparent that the occultation would be prolonged indefinitely. In other words, that the expectation for the return of the Imam in one's own lifetime was misplaced. It became apparent that the prolongation of the life of the Imam would be far beyond a natural lifespan. And therefore, in explanation, both for members of the community and for those who raise polemical objections from outside, analogies were drawn between the 12th Imam and other personages believed to have had a supernaturally prolonged lifespan. And here there are two completely opposed cases that are relevant, that are cited in the Shi'i literature. The first of them we've already touched on, Jesus. There are similarities in the circumstances of the birth of the 12th Imam and the birth of Jesus as recounted in the Quran. Remember that both Jesus and the 12th Imam speak immediately upon birth by proclaiming their message and their function, and also that both of them leave the earthly plane without suffering physical death. We've spoken of the Ghaiba at some length. As for the case of Jesus, then this is the relevant verse in the Quran, it's verse 157 of chapter 4, which states very explicitly, they, and here the subject is the Jews, they did not kill him or crucify him. In other words, not only he was not killed on the cross, he was not even placed on the cross in the first place. Verse 157 of chapter 4. And then the verse continues, rather we raised him unto ourselves. We, that is Allah, we raised him, we raised Jesus unto ourselves. We raised him to the divine presence. Now the Quran also, less explicitly but nonetheless plainly and unmistakably, indicates that Jesus will return. In verse 61 of chapter 43, Jesus is described as a sign of the hour, a sign of the hour. Of course, the verse is subject to a number of differing interpretations, but the most common interpretation is that the return of Jesus before the end of time will be a sign of its proximity. Also, from a purely logical point of view, it may be argued that every human, every living being is bound to undertake to taste death, as the Quran puts it, and every soul shall taste death. And therefore, if only to share in this universal experience of death, it is axiomatic that Jesus must return to the human plane. There are, of course, other important functions associated with his return, but this also is one argument in favor of his return from a doctrinal point of view. His return will be a sign of the proximity of resurrection. To return now to the parallel between Jesus and the 12th Imam, it is argued, therefore, that the life of Jesus at the time that the occultation of the 12th Imam, the major occultation of the 12th Imam, had begun, had already lasted much longer than a normal lifespan, close in fact to a millennium. And therefore, it is in principle entirely possible that other than Jesus should also have a preternaturally extended lifespan once removed from earth. And in case the argument appears to be somewhat arbitrary, saying if Jesus, then why not the 12th Imam? And in any event, how can a life be prolonged indefinitely absent from the physical plane? Then the answer is given that it is precisely the conditions of earthly life that cause decay and death. And therefore, that once a life is removed from the physical plane with all of the factors of decay and corruption that ultimately induce death, then its indefinite prolongation is entirely a matter of possibility, is entirely possible. In fact, we find this world being referred to, and here, of course, this is a general expression, not tied to Shi'ism. This world is referred to as Alam al-Kawni wal-Fasad. Alam al-Kawn wal-Fasad, that is, this is the world of generation and corruption. By corruption, we don't mean corruption in the moral sense, in the physical, material sense. Whatever comes into being, whatever is generated in this world, will ultimately corrupt, decay, and die. Therefore, if a life is subtracted from these, extracted from these conditions, its prolongation on a different plane is conceivable and possible. And so, here then, one parallel or one analogy advanced in favour of the major occultation, the indefinite prolongation of the life of the 12th Imam. Then we have a diametrically opposed case of miraculously prolonged existence, that of the figure known as the Dajjal.
The word Dajjal may reasonably be translated as the Antichrist, because a fuller designation of the Dajjal in Arabic is al-Masih Dajjal, al-Masih Dajjal. Masih being, of course, the title given in the Quran as Jesus Masih. So Dajjal is sometimes called more fully al-Masih Dajjal.
And we can therefore not simply by way of a parallel between two traditions, but quite literally translate Dajjal as the Antichrist. The maleficent figure that will appear at the end of time, whose existence is testified to in numerous traditions, both Sunni and Shi'i. He is the Antichrist in the sense that he parodies the miracles of Jesus, or that he will parody when he comes the miracles of Jesus, i.e. he will imitate those miracles. And his imitation will be successful. In other words, it is not a question of sleight of hand. He will indeed restore the dead to life. He will reverse the natural order by making, shall we say, water burning, and he will make fire cool. However, the source of this power is satanic rather than divine. The will, however, tradition tells us, both Sunni and Shi'i, that very many people will be unable to note this important difference, that the miracles performed by the Dajjal are of satanic rather than of divine origin. It is said that the Dajjal, in some traditions, it is said that the Dajjal existed already in the lifetime of the Prophet. This cannot be documented from the Quran. It is purely a question of hadith, both Sunni and Shi'i. And this being the case, Dajjal, just like Jesus, of whom he is the negative counterpart has a prolonged existence, and like Jesus will return at the end of time. So this too, in its own way, provides an analogy for the case of the 12th Imam. Anticipating what we will say later about the conditions and circumstances of the anticipated return of the 12th Imam, we can see that already there are these three figures or personages who will emerge at the end of time. Jesus, Dajjal, and the 12th Imam. And the eschatological scenario involves, in fact, interaction among these three, with, not surprisingly, the 12th Imam having, of course, supremacy. Dajjal is put to death, either directly by the 12th Imam or by Jesus acting on behalf of and at the instructions of the 12th Imam. But the point that is relevant now is that an indefinite prolongation of life outside of the material sphere has already, before the beginning of the occultation, these two diametrically opposed examples. So this was one answer that was given in answer to the doubts within the community. That is, indefinite prolongation of a life is indeed conceivable. The more important question may be, of what use is an imam who is in complete occultation, absent from the physical plane, without a named intermediary? Of what use is an imam, it was said, who is doubly removed from access by his community? Doubly removed in the sense that he has no named individual representative. And here, in answer to the question, the argument was in fact turned on its head. It was said that one purpose or use of the major occultation was in fact to vindicate the whole doctrine of the imamate. Why? Because, as we have seen, several of the imams had in their hadith predicted the occurrence of the occultation. So that the actual occurrence of the occultation vindicated the predictions made by the imam. Nordani, the same individual whose work we are summarizing here, Nordani says, considering the large number of traditions predicting the Ghaybah transmitted over the centuries, if the occultation had not occurred, then the very principle of the imamate would have been proved invalid. By occurrence of the Ghaybah, Allah has proved the authenticity of the Imam's warnings, and indeed their general veracity. So that, from this particular point of view, the occurrence of the Ghaybah, far from casting doubt on the principle of the imamate, serves as a vindication of it. An event that had been predicted by the Imam has now occurred, and therefore, not simply those predictions, but the general veracity of the imams has been proven. So that the Ghaybah, in other words, from being a doctrinal burden, has been turned into a factor of advantage. Then, in addition to this answer, we have other purposes of the imam during his occultation being suggested. First, it was said that the Ghaybah fulfilled, as it were, a punitive purpose. This we've already touched upon earlier. That is, the community was unworthy of the presence of the Imam on a physical plane. And it might be said that with respect to the Shia community, it had become increasingly unworthy in the time immediately before the occultation. In what sense? In the sense that after the death of Imam Hassan al-Askari, there had been widespread doubts within the community about the existence of the 12th Imam. instead of trusting in the general doctrine that the earth can never be without a hujjah, i.e. without an imam, people had raised all kinds of doubts and questions and split into a number of short-lived but nonetheless quite vigorous sects, putting forward different opinions. And then again, in the period of the lesser occultation, there had been doubts and problems being raised, as we have sketched already. Therefore, it can be said that the increasing withdrawal of the imam from presence on the physical plane, from access by the community, had gone together with, maybe even caused by, still further augmented unworthiness on the part of the community. And then, complementing this purpose of the Zayda, the punitive purpose, was what one might call the educational purpose, or the purgative purpose. In other words, if the community had proven unworthy of the imam, now was the chance for it to purge itself of that unworthiness by remaining patient in this prolonged period of separation. Patient in the sense of maintaining their belief in the imam and purifying themselves morally in such a way that his return, his ultimate return, might find a community ready, waiting for him, extending its sincere and comprehensive assistance to him. Then, too, it was said that the imam, even in a state of complete occultation, fulfilled yet another simple purpose, that is belief in him. To believe in the imam, irrespective of his accessibility or inaccessibility, his presence or his absence, is in itself of religious merit. Insofar as belief in the imam is one of the articles of faith, therefore, the simple act of believing in him, whatever its practical consequences, is it in and of itself of benefit. And beyond that, also, it is maintained sometimes that the very validity of all of one's religious acts, for example, prayer, fasting, other acts of devotion, pilgrimage, all of these depend for their validity on belief in the imam. In other words, if one does not have a belief in the imam from the point of view of Shia Islam, the validity of one's mandatory prayers is in itself dubious, or at least reduced. And therefore, from this point of view as well, the existence of the imam and belief in the imam, despite his absence, is of crucial benefit and desirability. So there are these varying answers that are given to this question. Ultimately, of course, however, the purpose of the imam, fulfilled by him, is a future one. That is to say, it is a postponement into the future, into a distantly anticipated future, of various functions that he will fulfill. But it will be useful here to examine some of the titles and epithets that are given to him. We can begin with that compound title that I already discussed in the previous connection, Qadim or Mahdi. Qadim or Mahdi. I pointed out that these attributes separately, taken separately from each other, are applied also excuse me, to some of the preceding imams. However, as a compound endowed with a particular sense, Qa'im al-Mahdi is a description of, an attribute of, exclusively the 12th imam. Let us go back to some of the ambiguities or the multiple meanings of the term Qa'im. The word qa'im, as I think I pointed out, may mean one who stands or one who arises. One who stands or one who arises. And beyond that, we should point out that from the point that in Arabic grammar, a present participle, like al-qa'im, may either have a present sense or a future sense. So one might translate al-qa'im either as the one who stands or the one who will stand, the one who arises or the one who will arise. And this too is relevant to the understanding of the title as bestowed on the 12th Imam. If we disregard the meaning of standing that applies to the term of qa'im and concentrate on the sense of rise, the one who arises, then clearly this taken in the future sense will apply only to the 12th Imam. In other words, al-qa'im is understood as an attribute of the 12th Imam to be the one who will arise in the future. He will stand up, he will rise in the future. He will rise in the future in order to vindicate the cause of the imamate. Another possible sense of al-qa'im, endowed with a future sense, is of course the one who will be resurrected. The one who will be resurrected. And this shade of meaning, again, gives rise, or has given rise in the past, to some problems of understanding. Because if we understand the 12th Imam to be the one who will be resurrected, al-qa'im in the sense of the one who will arise, i.e. who will arise from the grave, who will be resurrected at some point in the future, this must be taken to mean that he is not in favor, but has simply died, however, will be resurrected, as it were, selectively resurrected in the future in advance of the mass of humanity. And the marginal plausibility of this understanding is strengthened, or has been seen to be strengthened, even by some hadith from the Imams. We have a hadith from Imam Muhammad al-Baqir in which he says, our affair, our cause, i.e. the cause of the Shia, resembles that of a person who is put to death by Allah, who is caused to die by Allah for 100 years and then rises again. So here there is an explicit mention of death and resurrection. However, it can be said that here, of course, this is an analogy, well, not a precise analogy, a comparison. A comparison, an attempt to make a paranormal event comprehensible in terms of a familiar human experience, death. However, on the other hand, we have a hadith more problematic, more difficult to explain in this sense, from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, in which he says that the 12th Imam will rise after his death for an important task. He will rise after his death for an important task. And here we have the word death. There is no question of a comparison or analogy. And the explanation of this hadith, it has been said that here the Imam may have been speaking under conditions of taqiyyah. Under conditions of taqiyyah. You will remember taqiyyah, that is to say, dissimulation of true intent for reasons of prudence. In other words, it may have been thought desirable to convey the impression that the 12th Imam had indeed died a biological death. Alternatively, it has been said that here there is an implied metaphor. That is, rizayda for the non-believer is as good as death. Why? Because it is the lack of a tangible and a visible presence in this world. The important asking question is obvious, i.e. the important task that he will ultimately fulfill, the vindication of the Shia cause, upon his re-emergence. In any event, whatever one makes of these two hadiths, which raise or seem to raise in their wording the possibility of death as identical with a vapor, or at least comparable to it, there is the simple fact that the world will never be without a hujjah. The overriding principle that the world, creation, can at no time be without a hujjah, i.e. without an imam. Therefore the death of the imam is axiomatically impossible. Finally, in explanation of this problematic hadith, it has been said that what will in fact die out is not the imam himself, but awareness of him. And that his occupation will be so prolonged that he will die out from the memories of most people. So that it is as if he were dead. For most people, they have forgotten him, and it will therefore be as if he were dead, not he is actually dead. So to return from this excursus concerning death, it is very improbable that what is meant by Al-Qa'im is the one who will be resurrected. Rather, it is the one who will in the future rise up and vindicate the cause of the Shia. And if it be asked, how then can the same epithet be applied to preceding imams of Qa'im, who obviously did indeed die and whose rising up is not predicted, then one would have to have recourse to other meanings of the word Qa'im, because the verb in Arabic qama can also mean to undertake something, to have authority over, a wide range of meanings. For example, if we if we construe the verb qama with the preposition ala, qama ala, which means to have supervisory powers over. And clearly the imams in their time had supervisory powers over their community. Then again, the verb qama can be construed with the preposition bi, which means to undertake a certain task. Qama bi amri. And that also will be a sense appropriate to the exercise of the imamate by the preceding imams. As for al-mahdi, I've already talked about that on previous occasions. It remains only to remark, with respect to this title of the 12th Imam, that the primary designation is Al-Qa'im, and Al-Mahdi the secondary. Or to put it differently, we can think of Al-Qa'im here as a noun, and Al-Mahdi as being an adjective describing that noun. We have a hadith from Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, in which he says, when the Qa'im arises, he will distribute equally among all people, and he will be called al-Mahdi. When the Qa'im arises, he will distribute equally among people, i.e., he will engage in what, in modern terminology, might be called distributive justice. Resources, wealth, provisions will be allocated justly among mankind. And he will be called al-Mahdi. So al-Mahdi is a name that will accrue to him after he has emerged and arisen. Finally, with respect to these two terms, we should point out that al-Qa'im is an exclusively Shi'i term. It has hardly any resonance at all as a title or as an indication of a religious function in Sunni Islam. Whereas al-Mahdi, as previously pointed out, is to be found in Sunni usage. Sunni Islam also has the doctrine of the ultimate emergence at the end of time of a salvific figure. The difference being that the the Mahdi anticipated by Sunni Muslims, or at least by those of them aware of this traditional doctrine, will be born in the future, have a normal lifespan. It is probably fair to say, without trying to trace an origin or to assign a monopolistic possession of the concept of the Mahdi to either Sunni or Shia Islam, it's probably fair to say that the concept, because of the importance given to it in the overall doctrinal framework of Shia Islam, received emphasis above all in Shia Islam and then had some reflection in Sunni Islam as well. It is obvious that the figure of the Mahdi is not something upon which Sunni Muslims dwell. Many Muslims, many Sunnis these days, because of the absence in the Quran of any explicit mention to this day, would even deny its veracity. Whereas, of course, it is central to 12 Shiism, the belief in the emergence of a Qa'im al-Mahdi towards the end of history. And insofar as it has emerged in Sunni Islam, it may be because, quite simply, of the general recognition that the affairs of the world are too profoundly corrupt and disordered to be remedied except by the action of a person enjoying unique divine support and authority, which is of course a general human recognition, at least has been until maybe 20th century America, where it is imagined that with enough ingenuity and effort, virtually anything on the face of the earth can be put right. But if we put aside that deception to the general run of realistic pessimism in the history of humanity, the assumption is that the belief is that only through some mode of divine intervention at the end of time can matters, can history finally be put right. Which leads me, in fact, to the consideration of the second important designation given in the tradition to the Shah Imam, Mahdi al-Anam. Mahdi al-Anam, the Mahdi of mankind. The Mahdi of mankind, Mahdi al-Anam.
The sense of this is pretty obvious.
Excuse me, that the function of the Mahdi upon his re-emergence will be universal. He will not be sectarian. In other words, he does not simply emerge to assume or reassume the direct and visible leadership of the Shia community, nor even simply to vindicate the cause of the Imams within the broader Islamic community. He has ultimately a universal function. And one indication of this is that he will appear in Mecca. He will not appear in any of the sites peculiar to or specially emphasized in the sacred history of Shiism, not in Kufa or Karbala or Najaf, Tarjamain, Samarra, or even Medina, but rather in Mecca. And he will appear in Mecca in front of the Kaaba, which is, of course, the point of orientation of the Muslim community. But you might ask at this point, how does this square with the universal function of the Mahdi, if he appears at a point that is of particular importance to the Muslim community? Because the Kaaba is, of course, the primary, it is the primary indication of the divine unity upon earth. It is, as it were, the architectural expression of the divine unity, the terrestrial counterpart of the divine soul. And it is designated in the Quran as not simply being the house of Allah, the house established for the monotheistic worship of Allah, but also as a house established for mankind. And therefore, whether it's significant as such be acknowledged by humans in general is, from one point of view, beside the point. It is a house established for the entirety of mankind. and therefore the appearance then of the Mahdi at the Kaaba will be an indication of his universal mission. In the same connection, it is said that one of the functions of the Imam as Mahdi al-Anam when he appears at the Kaaba will be that he shall bring forth the unadulterated texts of all preceding revelations. He will bring forth the unadulterated texts, the uncorrupted texts of preceding revelations. Specifically, it is the Torah and the Injil I mentioned. The Torah and the Injil.
The Injil, which is of course transmissible by the Gospels,
but it should not be thought that what the Quran refers to as the Injil or is somehow equivalent to the New Testament as it currently exists. The Injil is a book that is revealed to Jesus according to the Quran. It is not the record, the somewhat contradictory and fragmentary record of his sayings and deeds that make him constitute the New Testament. So the Torah and the Injil, in their integrity, in their original form, will be brought forth by the Mahdi on his reappearance at the end of time. There are other aspects also of his function at the end of time, which we will more appropriately deal with later. Now I'm concerned above all with the titles given to him. Hajjah
I've already mentioned, and again this is obviously the title given to all of the Imams, because one of the functions, maybe the primary function of the Imam at any point, is to serve as the Hujjah, that is, the divine proof of his will to guide mankind, the divine will to guide mankind.
However, Al-Hujjah receives particular emphasis as a designation for the 12th Imam. It seems for the following two reasons. Firstly, that in the time of the lesser occupation, it was forbidden for the community to reveal the name of the Imam. It was forbidden for the community to reveal the name of the Imam. If you consider that his existence was kept a secret, then this will be part and parcel of that same effort to hide him from the hostile attention of the Abbasid caliph. His name itself was to remain unknown. And several of the wakils were in fact asked by members of the Shia community, tell us at least the name of our Imam. And they were refused, and instead the 12th Imam was referred to quite simply as Al-Hujjah. We find some of the traditions recorded from him, the hadith recorded from him, as being in the following form. Al-Hujjah ibn Hassan al-Askari said, Al-Hujjah, the son of Hassan al-Askari, the 12th Imam, said such and such. And then a second reason for the emphasis upon the 12th Imam being Al-Hujjah was that same doctrinal question that I previously raised and discussed, i.e. what is the purpose of the 12th Imam if he is in a state of complete occultation? And part of the answer given is that he is Al-Hujjah. So he often finds him described in a variety of contexts as Al-Hujjah. And he is Al-Hujjah of the time, beginning from the death of Imam Hassan al-Askari, continuously down to the present. And in fact, until his occultation, he is the Hujjah.
Two titles that refer explicitly to this Sahib al-Am, Sahib al-Jamal. Sahib al-Am,
صاحب الزمان. Literally, the lord or the master of the affair,
or the master of the age, صاحب الزمان.
These two are more or less synonymous with each other. The one who is entrusted with the affair, صاحب الأمر, that is the one who is entrusted during the period of the occultation with the imaming. Simply the words themselves do not provide any clue that this should be exclusively a title for the Prophet Imam himself. However, we have a hadith from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq in which he was once asked, "Are you Sahib al-Amr?" To which he answered, "No, he will be the one who will fill the earth with justice as it is now filled with injustice. No, he will be the one who will fill the earth with justice as it is now filled with wickedness." And a similar hadith from Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. So these hadiths point to the fact that Sahib al-Amr is a title which already in earlier usage was reserved for the 12th Imam. As for the second of these two virtually synonymous titles, Sahib al-Zaman, the Lord or the Master of the Age. The Zaman, the time, the period in question, is of course the entire period of the occultation.
And then finally, among the names of titles, Tahmiyat Allah. Tahmiyat Allah.
Which alone among all of these titles has a Quranic basis. We find it in verse 86 of chapter 11 of the Quran, which reads in part, Baqiyatullah, literally the remnant, that which is left behind by Allah, is better for you if you are believers. Baqiyatullah, that which is left by Allah, is better for you if you are believers. Baqiyatullahi khayrun lakum in kuntum mu'mineen. Baqiyatullah, what according to Shi'i exegetes is meant by this, precisely the person of the 12th Imam. He is the remnant, in the sense that he is the last personage left for the conveyance of divine guidance. In other words, prophethood and messengerhood were both sealed and brought to an end by the Prophet Muhammad, and now the line of Imams has also been brought to an end with the 12th Imam. So that remnant, that the last individual personification of the divine will to guide is the 12th Imam. Of course, it might be argued that the context of the verse does not indicate the 12th Imam, and the verse is capable of other interpretations. However, the condition placed at the end of the verse, in kuntum mu'mineen, this seems to be decisive, if you are believers. In other words, if you are believers in the totality of authentic doctrine, which from the point of view of Shia Islam includes the imame, then you will understand what is Baqiyat Allah and you will be able to draw upon its benefits. So there are these titles of the 12th Imam, which also indicate something about his function, admittedly his functions that lie in the future, but the anticipation of them already has a purpose for the Shia community in that it enables them to understand the purpose, the continuing purpose, as well as the future purpose of the imamate. But again, we have to balance this with the ongoing practical problems faced by the community. I already mentioned the question of the Khuns as one indication that practical problems arose in the community, what to do with the chumps. And we find on the plane of Shi'i law and jurisprudence some consequences occurring as a result of the rate of occultation and its indefinite prolongation. One may say, in short, and in anticipation of some later lectures, that now the authority of the imams, to one degree or another, devolves upon the religious scholars. This is a long and gradual process. It has its final crystallization in the doctrine of the rule by the religious scholar, Velayat al-Faqih, which is the constitutional basis of the Islamic Republic. That is, that in the absence, in the continued occultation of the imam, his governmental functions devolve upon not a single named individual, as was the case during the Nasser occultation, but rather upon the totality of the religious scholars, or on the most qualified among them, whether it be an individual or a group. However, from the beginning of the Greater Occultation to the articulation of that theory by Imam Khomeini and its application in the Islamic Republic, of course, many centuries pass. And one can say that there is a gradual accumulation of duties and functions performed by the religious scholars in the meantime. And the first is again the Khums. Soon the realization set in that the Khums could not be allowed to accumulate for no good purpose indefinitely. Therefore, the ulama, the religious scholars, regarded it as authorized that they should collect and distribute the khums on behalf of the imam. And going together with this also were a certain number of other functions. For example, the organization of courts. I've already spoken of the existence of a parallel judicial system under the Abbasid, a situation in which recourse to the courts, even for a just grievance, was forbidden by the imams to their followers. And we know that other courts operating under the general authority of the imam were in existence. Now, in the period of the occultation, we find that this function also is assumed by the religious scholars. This assumption of authority, of administrative and leadership functions by the scholars,
gradually acquires a particular name. Literally, the general, what should we say, a deputyship. As opposed to a niyabat al-khasa, specific definition. What is meant here is,
well, let's take the second one first.
Niyabat al-khasa, specific definition.
This refers retrospectively to the period of the Nasser occultation, when there were specific named deputies, wakils, safirs, acting on behalf of the 12 imams. When the period of a niyabat al-khasa came to an end with the onset of the Greater Occultation, then we have a niyabat al-amma, the general deputyship. And what is meant by the general deputyship
is that there is no longer a single named individual that is named by the 12th imam himself acting on his behalf. There is a diffuse and general deputyship exercised by the religious scholars. For this doctrine of a niyabat al-khasa, al-amma, the general deputyship of the religious scholars, there are of course numerous proofs to be found in the body of Shi'i hadith. But there is one which, significantly enough, is ascribed to the Prophet Imam himself, in which he's reported to have said, because in our absence, then consult on newly emerging problems those who narrate our traditions. In our absence, that is to say during the Ghaybah, consult on newly emerging problems. That is to say, problems for which no explicit and detailed guidance is available, either in the Quran or in the body of Hadith. Consult those who narrate our traditions. Those who narrate our traditions, that is to say, scholars who are aware of the traditions of the Imams and of the Prophet. But more than that, because the narration of traditions implies not simply memorization and transmission, but also awareness and understanding of the contents of the traditions. Therefore, this phrase, those who narrate our traditions, might reasonably be paraphrased as the religious scholars in general, the scholars of the Islamic law. So we can say then that the problem within the Shia community of administration, leadership and guidance after the onset of the Great Rock Occultation gradually attains its solution by means of this principle and the article and the assumption by the religious scholars of an accumulating series of functions that made possible not simply the continuation but even the consolidation of the Shia community in the occultation of the Imam. Whatever be the scriptural arguments in favor of this development, and they are indeed numerous, this may be a more general consideration, that is that the Shia Islam has as part of its essential genius a heavy emphasis upon transmitted authoritative transmitted and legitimate authority. In just the same way, well, not in just the same way, but there's a comparison that can be drawn. There is the legitimate succession first to the Prophet himself by the Imam. And then once the institution of the Imamate has not ended, but has been modified, conditioned by Reda, then there is again a transmission of legitimate authority, or better to say a devolution of it, to the religious scholars. So that this underlying feature of Shiism, I think, can be invoked to explain the great coherence and solidity of Shi'i tradition after what appears to be, from an external point of view, a great and puzzling crisis at the beginning of the Great Rock Occultation. So I will leave it there for today and talk next time about the anticipated return of the Imam, its conditions and its time. Thank you.